from Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican Chris Voronis, Democrat Dan Johnson, Libertarian Sean Bennett, and Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago. Our phone lines remain open, are open at 1-800-723-8289 as we come to you from the Radio Hall of Fame Gallery at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. If you would like to send us an email, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you want to catch the show on the internet, it's beyondthebeltway.com. Not only this show, but for every show we've done for about a decade now. Tonight, obviously, we're going to be talking about campaign politics. And again, I think if you were to ask maybe some Republicans, maybe a large number of Republicans, if you would ask independents, and certainly if you ask Democrats to list one of the high points of the Obama presidency, it was almost a year ago when President Obama gave the decision that ended up in Osama bin Laden being shot to death. And he's off the face of the earth, and most people think that's a very good idea. Certainly most Americans feel that. The question now has come up, how much should a president celebrate something like that? And it comes up because Joe Biden suggested in his speech the other day, he said there's two things that you've got to remember in his speech. Osama bin Laden is dead, and General Motors is alive, sort of taking a slap at Romney. And there's a new spot out that suggests, that produced by the Obama administration, suggesting and raising the question as to would Mitt Romney have made that same decision, that same call on Osama bin Laden. So I want to spend a little bit of time tonight as we kick off the discussion. We'll start with our Democrat, Dan Johnson. How much can you toot your own horn on a big issue like this?
Well, I think that's what reelection campaigns are for. I'm kind of surprised that somebody would suggest that we shouldn't be celebrating the fact that our president took out our number one enemy and shifted his foreign policy away from the disastrous war in Iraq and focused on our enemy. So that's the success. A promise was made, kept, delivered. Absolutely.
An answer and a shot to the other side. Let's go to Chris Voronis. Chris, again, you're in the public relations business. Yeah. You lead with your strength. That is one of his strengths, is it not?
For sure, it is. And
so is there anything wrong with the spot that's been out there that raises the question as to whether or not Mitt Romney would have made the same decision?
Well, a couple things. One is it is ridiculous and absurd to put a TV spot out there talking about what Mitt Romney would or wouldn't have done. Suppose Thomas Dewey, who won, beat FDR. Would Pearl Harbor have been different? It's ridiculous to put a spot out there, and they know that, but
why
doesn't
is it
matter.
Ridiculous? Why is it ridiculous to put a spot out there?
Because it's impossible to get inside the decision-making of one man as leader of a country
not the purpose of a spot. The purpose of the spot is to move people. Sean Bennett, our libertarian, what do you think? Is that fair?
In this particular circumstance, Obama didn't have any military experience when he came in as president, and Romney doesn't have any military experience if he comes in as president. So I do think it's kind of a ridiculous thing to ask him. The other thing that I want to bring up is that it emerged this week that one of the primary admirals was given a lot of the leeway in the decision-making on whether to go forward or not on the bin Laden raid. It was not it was framed such that Obama said, okay, Admiral, do this, do that, and you're going to call the shots, and you're going to decide whether this is 51% or 49%, and you're going to go
ahead. Charles Lipson, is it fair?
We're down
to raise that subject.
It's absolutely fair. It's absolutely fair. We're down in the weeds. It's a great, great ad. And the only objection that I've heard has been from Charlie Krauthammer, who says that it goes too far in sort of implying that Romney, taking Romney's own words as quoted by other people. Yeah. I actually thought that was part of what made the ad effective. That may not have been fair. for the reasons that you've stated. But it's a great ad, and with Clinton, the only thing is when
it's also a great ad because we're talking about it tonight.
Right.
They talked about it on the Sunday
when
show.
When I hear Clinton use the word honorable, I have to pull back from the screen. But it's a great ad.
Yeah, is it fair or right or legal to share semi-classified documents with Catherine Bigelow to make the movie about bin Laden and release it around Election Day? I think that goes beyond celebration and spiking the football in the end zone.
If they keep doing it over and over again, I think it will boomerang on them. I think it'll look.
Would you agree that for an independent voter, and maybe even for some moderate Republicans, that this is a big deal, this is a potential key to whether or not they will support him a second time, because they probably did the first time?
The reason it's important is that in the absence of something really big happening in Iran, for example, or elsewhere on the international stage, it completely takes foreign policy off the table as an issue. And the Republicans normally run on the issue that the Democrats are weak on foreign policy, and you can't do it this time.
Dan, in your view, if we were to go inside the mind of a candidate who isn't even president yet, would any president have decided not to move forward on what President Obama moved forward on with the information that we all know, which isn't more than what we read?
You know, what we just learned this week from his former chief of staff, Bill Daley, is that it was a real risk that the president took, and that, as he put it, you couldn't get a search warrant with the amount of evidence we had at 26 in California, where our criminal courts in Chicago are located. He said, which was new to everybody that doesn't work at the White House, this was a real risky gamble that the president took to try to go after Osama bin Laden, and it worked. So I think I think it's entirely legitimate to say, would the other presidential candidate take the same move? That's what we're called on as voters to do.
I think there's a concrete difference here. I want to make an analogy between Obama's running on hope and change in 2008 and the ambiguity of the detail involving the bin Laden raid that is still with us as of this week. There was a judicial ruling by Boas Berg, who was an Obama appointee in 2011, that we will not be releasing the photographs of bin Laden's dead body. They will not be addressing him being buried at sea.
Do you agree with that? Do you agree with that decision?
The reason I don't agree with that decision is because, to me, it reeks of them covering up or waxing nostalgic on the story, giving it a commissioner report feel. If you look at what happened with Gaddafi, they paraded him in the street, they put him on the news, he was all over the web, people went past his casket, he was not buried in one day like a Muslim was supposed to be. In the case of bin Laden, they buried him at sea, which is not supposed to happen unless you're killed at sea and when you're a Muslim, and they sealed the records again this week. They're running on this ambiguity of this foreign policy decision that an admiral made.
I want to come back and get everyone else's response to that, as well as people listening around the country. 1-800-723-8289. Do you think those pictures should be released? The White House, the advice is that they're not going to do it. Sean just made a case that maybe they should. What do you think? 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Also, on the bigger, broader issue, whether or not the president should wrap himself in the assassination of Obama, of bin Laden. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Again, I got a little tongue-tied at the end of that break. We were obviously talking about Osama bin Laden, not Barack Obama. So clarify that point. Sean said that he thinks the pictures should be released. He certainly is implying that there may be some conspiracy, some skullduggery that we don't really know what happened there. Are you a believer of that? I mean, do these pictures, should they be released?
you have to balance two kinds of concerns. One is that I generally favor openness in government. On the other hand, you don't want to release something that would actually put real American lives in danger, and especially soldiers that we have in Afghanistan and elsewhere throughout Southwest Asia, in danger. My sense is that the, as I would say in a court, the probative value of releasing these pictures is relatively low, and the chance that it would be used to mobilize against our soldiers is relatively high. So I would not overturn the court's ruling.
Chris, what do you think of that?
The principal reason that people wanted to release those photos was to prove that he was dead. And otherwise, no photos, no proof. But I think if you're Obama and you can get people like Jim Inhofe, ultra-conservative senator from Oklahoma, see the photos and agree that he was dead, and even Al-Qaeda itself, I think they did a pretty good job making it clear that, one, he was dead, and two, in kind of like in a matter of taste and decency, don't release the photos.
So the release of those is prurient at this moment.
I don't think it was the right call, what the administration did.
Dan?
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I wouldn't release them.
Okay. Now, on the bigger, broader issue, does it, getting back to whether or not in a campaign, is this story going to keep coming back again and again, suggesting that, you know, that Mitt Romney might not have done the exact same thing that
They're going to run the risk if they keep bringing it back again and again, of more and more details coming forward that show that aspects of the way that it was handled in the aftermath appear PR-like. For example, it's known and admitted by the White House that famous photograph that everybody has seen in the Situation Room with all the people and Hillary Clinton with her hand over her mouth and so on staged, and it was taken immediately before he made the announcement of Osama bin Laden's death on television. I think that...
Is that true?
Yes, that is true, and the White House has confirmed that.
What does that say to you?
It says to me that they're not letting the opportunity go the wayside from a PR perspective, thinking that is a key driver that's going to help him during his
re-election. But why shouldn't they do that? I'm coming back to why would any president not want to accentuate...
But doesn't it appear disingenuous if aspects of it that they're admitting to were staged.
But again, insofar as classic photographs, I mean, the Iwo Jima photograph was staged. I mean, there are photographs that are staged for political events. They have significance to them.
I'm confident that Romney would have ordered the invasion of Iwo Jima.
But it is fair, I believe, it is fair to use his words.
Absolutely.
Right. Because when that idea was floated by candidate Barack Obama, Mitt Romney criticized
it,
as did Hillary Clinton.
That's all true, but we're missing the big picture here. The big picture is that in the absence of some dramatic foreign policy event, the death of Osama bin Laden on President Obama's watch strengthens his credentials in foreign policy and largely diminishes that case that the Republicans can make against him. This case is going to be fought out over other issues, not mostly foreign policy.
I disagree that it rests the foreign policy issue, because if you hit the nail on the head with Fast and Furious over and over again, that's definitely a foreign policy concern.
Well, okay, if you want to consider that a foreign policy
issue. Guns running to Mexico, and 68,000 of the 99,000 that have been retrieved came from the U.S. From the ATF last year, and so on. That is a foreign policy issue that the Republicans have a lot of muster on in this reelection campaign.
Why have they not pushed it?
I think that they're waiting to see if holding Eric Holder in contempt of court goes through. That's something that they're positioning.
What do you mean goes through? They can push it through.
They want to see whether or not that sticks in the media, and also whether that sticks in the Senate inquiry and the House inquiry.
Is the ticking time bomb in this game, however, the Supreme Court? Isn't the Supreme Court going to define much of the landscape of this campaign?
If the five justices decide to repeal a significant part of the Affordable Care Act, I think it's going to be hard to have a debate on any other topic in November, because then we haven't solved a lot of our unaffordable health care system, and the question will be, what are we going to do about it? In my view.
President Obama has got to be accountable to the fact that he knew that there were serious constitutional problems with individual mandate, and he pushed this through anyway.
And now the chickens are coming home to roost. And you know what? Everybody signed it, you know, raised their hand, took an oath to honor the Constitution. They believe it's constitutional. Five Supreme Court justices go the other way. It's not like you did something wrong. You just took a different view.
To take up a whole year on the legislative calendar, dominated by Obamacare.
Right, and he spent all his political capital on this.
A whole year.
And the Supreme Court strikes it down.
And he taught constitutional...
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
I mean, he still has to explain himself.
Look,
I mean, he was my teacher.
I know. He was your teacher. Did he teach you this?
He said, look, watch out. There are five radicals on the Supreme Court. They can interpret the Constitution any way they want in behalf of corporate interests.
This will be a big issue, and so will...
Just kidding. He did not say that.
So will the decision on Arizona. But
where do you see that coming down?
Play out
the ramifications of that decision.
It looks like it'll be a heavy majority, possibly 8-0. One Justice, Elena Kagan, recused herself because she'd been part of the Obama administration formulating the case. Ruling that the key parts of the Arizona law, not all of it, but key parts of it may be found constitutional. I think that it will have the effect ultimately on balance of harming the president, but it will mobilize possibly the Hispanic base, which will help him.
I agree.
It will help.
It helps put Arizona back in play.
I think it harms Obama because
I think
if
so
you,
too.
First of all, if you look at what Sotomayor said, she said, look, I'm paraphrasing, we're just not buying this line of argument that it somehow impedes the federal government's ability to enforce a law, to have the state make a phone call to the federal government and say, here we have somebody who is breaking federal law.
But parts of it that go beyond the federal law may be found unconstitutional. But I want to say that the biggest news that came out in the past week is none of this. The biggest news that came out is that the GDP numbers were at 2.2, not 3%. This growth is slowing. If it continues to remain slow, it will be a very tough uphill slog for the president.
Another aspect of this is a poll that came out this week said that 45% of Hispanics surveyed favored the Arizona law. 43% do not favor it. So this inside the Beltway, you know, pontifical BS, which we've heard for 5 years now, is, boy, if you speak up, you're going to get all the Hispanics mad at you and they're never going to vote Republican. Well, that is totally, totally BS. Yeah. It's not true. And yet they keep saying it over and over again. I'm glad we finally have a poll out there that based a reputable firm basically has said the majority of Hispanics who were surveyed said, you know what, if they're breaking the law, I'm not going to support that.
Yeah. Well, and I think Charles makes a great point. And this, what you could have with the 2.2% anemic growth, is the issue that takes the luster off of the bin Laden raid crown on Obama. Just like the mission accomplished, landing on the aircraft carrier in reverse. That was supposed to be the one thing that was going to take George Bush down, and it didn't. So people have short memories. And they certainly did with Katrina. It's not to say that Obama didn't make a tough call. He made a tough call. It paid out. He should celebrate it. Not spike the football in the end zone, giving semi-classified documents to a Hollywood director, making a big movie right before the election. But Charles' point, it's hard to say that we're safe when you don't have a job.
I can tell you, it is hard to find these jobs out there. I've got one child who's been who's pretty qualified, who lost a particular job, and has been working extremely hard to find another job. I have two children. One is a web designer. He's pretty actively employed, but the other child has had a real difficulty.
Dan?
Well, that's right. And I think the question is, what's our national strategy to improve employment?
What is it?
Well, I think what Barack's is includes a lot of public works to put people back to work. And the Republicans in the Tea Party said absolutely not. They've turned that off. And there's been real job loss.
One of the biggest questions
that I think is going to come up will be in Wisconsin a month from now when there's a recall election for Scott Walker, who was, you know, the Tea Party agenda personified, and Wisconsin has the worst job growth in the country. And I think if Wisconsin turns against Scott Walker, who's the darling of the radical Tea Party right, and if he loses his recall election, I think that's a phenomenal sign.
And the other
we're going to come back and talk about that. We're also going to talk about Veep Steaks when we return. 1-800-723-8029. Sean Bennett has a whole concept of how it's all going to be figured out and how you can remember it, and we'll do that when we come back. Back in Chicago tonight, we welcome our Democrat. He is Dan Johnson, and he is a lobbyist, and he's a lawyer, and he has his own firm. And in 50 words or less, your firm does what?
We represent clients before the Illinois General Assembly, changing the world one law at a time.
Also with us is Chris Varonis. He is the head of AESOP Communications, and he and Dan are longtime friends and frequent guests on this program. Charles Lipson is the pride of Marks, Mississippi. He is a longtime professor of political science at the University of Chicago. And Sean Bennett also joins us. And Sean is the head of his own arbitrage company and also a music jingle company and is a libertarian. And that's our guests. These are our guests for this evening. A reminder that we do this program from the Museum of Broadcast Communications. And if you are within the sound of my voice, I can tell you that on June 12th, the museum will celebrate its 25th anniversary. We have a big gala benefit starring Betty White. She will be here in person along with John Mahoney and Hugh Downs, the three icons of American television. You can purchase your tickets online at museum.tv, 6 to 10 o'clock at night, and the following day on the 13th, exactly on the 25th anniversary of when we very first opened the museum back in 1987. At 10 o'clock in the morning, we will cut the ribbon, or Betty White and Hugh Downs and John Mahoney will cut the ribbon, and the museum that you've heard me talk about for many, many years, far too many years on this program, we will be reopened. Both the radio and television floors at the museum will be reopened.
Congratulations, Bruce. It's a real achievement. Yeah. It's a real achievement.
You all can be there, and again, if you're listening, again, it'll be a unique moment when you have, with Betty White and with Hugh Downs, you have two people who perhaps they have been on television more than any two human beings alive, and they will all be here together. And, of course, Hugh Downs, his great career started in Chicago at the Merchandise Mart. He was an announcer on a lot of kids' shows.
Yeah. You know,
Hawkins
that
Falls,
program,
and this is where his career started.
That program, when it first started, the Today Show, had a real Chicago feel because Dave Garraway gave it that feel.
That's
and
right.
Hugh Downs carried that on.
Followed, as did John Chancellor. The first several of the first hosts all had a Chicago connection. So, again, they will all be here. Again, Betty White, live and lively. She'll be live at the museum on June 12th. And come on in. You can support a worthy cause at the same time.
Bruce, my wife was asking, is that a black tie event?
It is not. It's going to be on a Tuesday night. It's after work, so you can save some money on a tuxedo.
Good.
You can get gussied up another way. But wear your black suit. I wouldn't wear your
from the prom.
White bucks.
Just come from the prom.
Yeah, right. Beautiful.
I like a prom.
Why not?
I like your prom.
Excellent.
History in the making.
It'll be fun.
I mentioned before the break that one of the great parlor games that is being played in politics, political homes all over the country now, is Veep Steaks as to who is going to be the running mate for Mitt Romney. And last week, Marco Rubio was on all the Sunday morning shows, and I think did a very good job of representing himself and introducing himself to much of the American people. But this past week, he ended up with an $8,000 fine from the Federal Election Commission. And the hometown newspaper in Miami, the Miami Herald, they did sort of a hatchet job on him and suggesting that maybe he's not ready. Even Joe Scarborough from Coffee Joe or Coffee
Morning Joe.
Morning Joe basically took a slap at his Republican from the state, saying that he wasn't ready, too young, too inexperienced. Do you agree with that assessment, a little too young?
I think
40 years old?
The best thing for Marco Rubio is to win re-election in the U.S. Senate, to sit it out. And it's unclear as to what his real desire is, just to get his to get his medal out there, or if he's really, really interested in the vice presidency. I mean, for me, the best bet for Mitt Romney is Bob Portman, a guy who looks like Romney, not just physically, but in a lot of ways, complements him and really ups his creds as the fix-it guy. Bob Portman definitely has that. He brings Ohio with him. And I think also with Mitt Romney, with Bob Portman, you get a guy who doesn't threaten Mitt Romney, which I think is important for him.
All right. And that's a perfect segue to Sean Bennett, because Sean, the last time he was on the program a couple of weeks ago, we were just about to introduce this this little game that we're about to play. And it was too little too late. But tell us how you are going to assess and how you are going to look into the crystal ball and figure out who the vice presidential running mate is likely to be.
I think there's two key issues with selecting the vice president. The first and most foremost is, will they be ready to be president? I think a lot of people will be asking themselves that question if they're an independent. The second issue, and this was brought up a couple of weeks ago on the show, was that if you look at the 8 or 9 swing states, which are the most key to winning the Electoral College, that pretty much you have to have a connection that is going to help you win one of those states, because it's as few as 800,000 votes that have to switch sides in order to cause a 110 electoral vote swing. So what I've come up with is a little mnemonic device, which we can put up on the screen.
Let's take a look.
And that
and
helps
us. And by the
way,
for those listening to on radio, it says VP of WIN paren N paren.
Yeah,
and
so
what does
the
that
VP,
mean?
VP of the win. In order to win the vice presidency, you have to be able to impact the states that are beginning with the letters in that phrase. So we have Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida, Wisconsin, Indiana, and the N's could be any of a basket of N states, from Nevada to North Carolina to New Jersey, and even in some cases. And a lot of people have difficulty remembering what all the swing states are. Everybody kind of remembers Florida because of Bush versus Gore. Okay. And everybody kind of remembers Iowa and Ohio because of other recent elections. But when you get down to the nitty-gritty, you don't realize that a 6-point swing in this state and a 5-point swing in that state, unless you live in that state. So this is a way to both remember the swing states, VP of win, and also if somebody is from that state or they have a connection to that state. So, for example, even somebody as outlandish a pick as Huntsman went to University of Pennsylvania. He's got a Pennsylvania connection. He has the ability to connect with Pennsylvania voters. If they don't influence voters in those states, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. And Romney has to play it almost perfectly with his VP pick, with his ability to do well in the debates, with his ability to win over women and Latinos, and he has to win Florida. If you look at one of Obama's strategists' permutations, if you got 10 swing states, that's 1,024 permutations. He ran an analysis, and in 900 of them, Obama won. Of all of the ones that Romney won, the 85 remaining ones, he had to win Florida in all of them.
Do you believe, going back to what Chris said, Charles, do you think Marco Rubio is ready to be on a national ticket?
I think it'll be a question. I actually do think
that. Wait, that was my question.
I mean,
It has to be an answer.
I'm sorry. I thought this
come up with an answer.
I thought it had to be in the form of a question.
No,
Alex,
just answer the question.
I think,
Senator,
that it will be a question in voters' minds. It's not a question in my mind. That is, it's not just that he's been a senator for a short period of time. He was prior to that the head of the House in Florida.
Speaker of the House. Speaker.
And I think he's actually a fairly experienced legislator. I think that that it will either be him or Portman. Portman is clearly much more ready, and Portman would bring something to the ticket in terms of governance. That is, he has Washington experience in a way that Romney does not.
Does he? Because he has Washington experience with George Bush, does that hurt him?
That would hurt him, and it would be doubling down. It would be doubling down on boredom.
But no. They will make the case that although he had involvement with the budget with Bush, and you know the deficit increased by $4-something trillion, yeah, that Obama has increased the deficit by $5 trillion so far.
Now, I think you get zipped. Let's let
the card carrying Democrat really rain on the Rubio parade.
Well,
why is he? Is he too young? Too good looking. What's his problem?
He's certainly more. Smart. He's certainly better than Sarah Palin.
Well,
okay,
right? A Cuban Barack Obama, maybe.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. Look, I don't buy the idea that your VP gets you a state. I don't think people, you know, say, hey, look, you know, the vice president's from Wisconsin, so, you know, I'm going to vote for Mitt Romney because you pick somebody from my state. I think there was an article out this week that showed
even Rubio with Florida.
I just don't buy it. I think there are certain candidates.
Anybody else agree with me?
I agree with you.
We all agree.
Okay,
right. Except Dan.
So, you know, again, because data is on my side, and you all disagree.
Florida will be close. Florida will be close, and having a few extra people who are part who are influenced by Rubio, and it will be turnout, not people who switched their votes.
Yeah. Well, and let's not forget, Florida is probably the state that's hardest hit by mortgages,
right,
and that's all on Obama.
And
right,
Nevada,
now,
which is another swing state. Both of those are.
But see, when you say something like that's on Obama, then the question is, well, what are you going to do about it? And the debate's going to be pretty clear. Do you want to regulate the banks? Do you want to force them to put more money in the pockets of homeowners? I mean, which side are you on?
Bruce,
and I think those big questions, I don't think that's good for Republicans.
Is a female candidate, do you think they're real, or is that just is it a gimmick?
There should be one.
I'm not aware of many viable candidates that are out
well,
there.
Well, he's campaigning with New Hampshire Senator Kelly Ayotte right now.
I think it's a
today's
gimmick.
Campaign.
I think it's a gimmick because I don't think that any of them have really shown national heft. Whereas you're seeing Rubio,
Sarah Palin, of course.
Well, and that was
not the right stance. I want to get your response as well. 1-800-723-8289. Do you have a pick for vice president? Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Again, the story this week is Marco Rubio was fined $8,000 by the Federal Election Commissioners because he had contributions totaling $210,173.09. And he had raised $21 million for his Senate campaign. But again, the FEC slapped him on the wrist for $8,000. And if you say, what, haven't we heard a story like this before? Yes, you hear it frequently. In 2008, the FEC fined Joe Biden. You remember Joe Biden, the vice president of the United States. His campaign was fined $218,000 because they said they found potential problems with $2 million in contributions. So one guy was fined $8,000. The other guy is fined $218,000. One guy raised $21 million. The other guy has raised $2 million. So of the $2 million, I mean, he had to spend $218,000 in fines. That was for the campaign in 2008 when he was running against Barack Obama. So it seems to me that although the media loves to go into these FEC stories, as well they should, I mean, that issue is not going to have any – that should not derail him because he
that won't
failed.
Derail. Well,
but you think there will be other things.
A little quick math on that shows it's the fine per bad dollar raised was 40% as much for Rubio as it was for
Biden. There's going to be no math for the voters.
However, I think it has done some damage because 2 weeks ago – Rubio was trading on Intrade at 25% likelihood of being the vice president. As of today, he was trading at 18% likelihood of being the vice president, and only 1% better than Portman or McDonnell. So,
well, Bob McDonnell could be as strong. Again, there's your V for Virginia.
Yeah.
Born in Chicago, but he's a Chicagoan, an Illinoisan, I believe.
He has a big hurdle Lake to overcome Forest. With the women, though, because yes. of the transvaginal ultrasound bill that he signed into law about it.
And you see, that right. that would not play well because, again, the other underlying issue in all of these states is obviously trying to close the gender gap. So that would be
that's a real problem.
He's a Notre Damer. That's mm-hmm. a positive thing. He's Roman Catholic. Portman is Portman Catholic. Does anybody know?
I don't know.
Anybody from WKBN, let us know. But again, tell us about if you're listening to us on WKBN, I know we have a lot of listeners in Ohio. Give us a call, 1-800-723-8289. Tell us about how he is viewed back in Ohio, because you said something, Charles, and everybody sort of nodded, that they say he's because he's boring, and they think that Romney is boring.
Romney is boring. I think everyone would concede he's a very boring gentleman.
I don't think he's boring. I don't think he's boring. I mean, he's not.
You have
he's
really
not a
low standards.
He's not a celebrity.
I think he comes across as cool.
Yeah,
and whereas Obama comes corporate. Across as warm and charismatic, and I think that's a difference.
Obama has a cool monotone to him. No drama. Obama has been something he's had to struggle with over these last.
Right.
Years.
I think that Romney comes across as a kind of business executive, and I think Portman a bit too. The issue is not they're both they both have their opinions. I was just saying that Rubio is somebody who goes out and can give a stemwinder. People yeah. are actually motivated around him. He has that's an advantage for him.
But is Portman he believable? But part of it is the credibility and the believability right. of a 40-year-old first year senator. I mean, Obama was not much older than that. But I'm just saying right. is he believable of being a heartbeat away?
I think that some voters will have that question. I think you're right to raise it.
Sometimes the Freudian slip says all. And when he said 6, 7, 8 years into the vice presidency, meaning to say Senate, everybody knew that this was first and foremost on his mind, even if he's denying he wants it, saying, I want to go back to the Senate, saying, I want to do this.
What's wrong with it?
It's
of course everybody knows he wants it. Who's going to turn it down on the list? Who's going to turn it down?
The only reason he would turn it down is if he thought that there was so little viability for Romney to become president that it would become a political liability for him to run on the ticket.
Because Republicans, in the Democrats... among the Democrats, you run once and then you're never heard from again. Among Republicans, the number two always seems to end up in the hunt.
Cindy
the next time.
In Boardman, Ohio, listening to us tonight. Is Rob Portman, what religion is he? Do we know?
I don't know what he is, but I think Romney is likable. I mean, we're burning here. You know the saying, Rome is burning, and we're talking about if he's likable or not. I mean, we need leaders. Come on.
That's a great point.
Paul, too.
Well,
I have so much on my mind. There's a lot of people that don't vote in this country. They figure what for. And a lot of times I'll hear both parties are the same. They're not much different. But we need leaders. We're burning here.
Well, that's what a campaign is going to be about. And the question is going to be whether or not Romney's going to be able to continue to make the case in the general election. And, he obviously has made the case to win the Republican nomination.
For the caller's very point. Coming from Ohio, that's why I think Romney-Portman ticket reinforces the competency narrative that Romney's going for. That is, Obama is in over his head. He's great with soaring rhetoric, but the reality is trails far behind. And I think a Romney-Portman ticket gets them closer to that narrative.
You know, the problem, though, is that everybody likes to be the maverick insurgent outsider. And at least Romney, a lot of swing voters like that. And so Romney at least could say, hey, I'm not a Washington guy. I'm here to shake it up. If you get a George Bush, budget director, it's hard to say, I'm the maverick, I'm shaking things up, I'm going to be the independent, I'm the outside Washington person, going to fix things, and I'm bringing in the George Bush guy. Because it is really easy for us then to say, well, you know, pick your poison, because things were
pretty
horrific.
Yeah, but we're not going to make the ultimate decision on a vice president.
And I think bringing up George W. Bush is really, it's past its sell-by date.
I don't think so.
Well, in this case, Portman is more exciting than Cheney was.
Yeah. Cheney was picked for governance purposes, and I think if Romney goes for who will be the best to help him in governing, it's clearly Portman, and Portman will help in Ohio.
All right, 1-800-723-8029. If you're listening to us on radio, we have just begun to talk. We have another full hour coming up, and in the next hour, we will reveal the religion of Romney. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. Food fight. Bruce Dumont back on Beyond the Beltway, hour number two, where a food fight is broken out during our little break. Tonight, featuring commentary by Republican Chris Varonis, Democrat Dan Johnson, Libertarian Sean Bennett, and Charles Lipson, the adult in the room, professor from the University of Chicago, coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, 1-800-723-8289. I never thought that just a few Doritos around the table would turn everybody silly.
It turned into something like a John Belushi movie here.
Verona's just popped. He just lost it.
The Doritos.
He popped.
All we've got here is just Doritos. No brownies, just Doritos. We are now moving on to hour number two. By the way, we were able to confirm that Rob Portman, who is the candidate of choice of Chris Varonis, our Republican, and obviously he's not alone because there's a lot of people that like Rob Portman as a possible candidate, even though he has been summarily dismissed as a boring candidate, which I think is
unfair. That wasn't dismissal. That was high praise.
Well, I know, but somehow the media always wants, they want a darling. They want showbiz pizzazz. They don't necessarily look for competence. And then when they get competence, they don't like competence because they don't like the competence, the politics of the person who's competent. They didn't like Dick Cheney either. And look what happened to him. Anyway, Rob Portman is the United States Senator from Ohio.
Does anybody really like Dick Cheney?
I like Dick Cheney.
You think he's likable? Do you like Darth Vader?
Do I like Dick Cheney? I'll tell you why I like Dick Cheney and why I admire Dick Cheney. And history has not been kind to him, but history will be kind to him because there's a lot of things that Dick Cheney did that we don't know about.
Right.
There's some things we do know about. And I would say that about 50% of the people don't like what some of the things he did. The other 50% are cheering. There has not been another attack on the United States. I think that has a lot to do with Dick Cheney. I think
Dick Cheney wouldn't have a comprehensive continuity of government plan if it wasn't for Dick Cheney. Right.
So there.
So what religion? But you can admire Rob Portman, Bruce.
The nominees are Catholic, Protestant,
Baha'i.
No, he is a Methodist.
I see.
Oh. That question came up because everybody wants to know what the running mate's religion is. He is was a partner in a law firm in Cincinnati, served in the General Assembly, served in the United States Congress. He was known for being a deficit hawk. He promoted the historic welfare reform efforts as a member of the committee that wrote the legislation that changed things. He was a forceful advocate for the balanced budget amendment that passed in 1997. He left Congress in 2005 when he was asked to serve as the United States Trade Representative. That's a cabinet-level office responsible for implementing and enforcing U.S. trade policy. 1 year into the job, he was successful in reducing barriers of U.S. exports and increasing enforcement of trade laws to help level the playing field.
You're reading
He is director
his...
of the... No, this is off the top of my head. Okay. He is director of the office... Gave it away. It's rated. It's theater of the mind.
I saw you in Rain Man, didn't I? Okay.
It's my territory.
He was director of the Office of Management and Budget, period. A deficit hawk, comma. No, he's a deficit hawk. Anyway, that's and he took over for George Voinovich. Of course I'm reading that.
But he will have.
We're in the radio hour now. Right. We can read everything.
Yes, really.
Why don't you just tell everybody?
Do you hear the man walking up behind you?
You write your ad-libs before the show.
I hear the
this
man
is a
walking
totally
up
scripted
behind me.
Program. There is something that we're going to get serious here for a while, now that we've been silly for a while. Near and dear to your heart, Sean, is CISPA.
Yes.
Set it up. Tell the folks what it is. It's not a new car by General Motors. Tell us what it is and why it has a bee in your bonnet.
It is the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. It's the bill that followed SOPA, which a lot of people heard about, Stop Online Piracy Act. It's designed to be a suite of bills and legislation, and it's being sold to Congress as a way to protect infrastructure from cyber terrorism and cyber attacks and things like that, as are the other three bills that went through Congress this week on similar topics. The problem with the bill is that it has had a lot of amendments in recent days. It was rushed to a vote on Thursday. It passed by a margin of about 80 votes.
In the Republican House.
In the Republican House. And the problem with it is that suppose you've ever gone on YouTube and watched a video that contained a copyrighted image. You wouldn't know that until you were halfway through watching the video. You might not even know it after you watch the video.
A lot of the videos say, I don't even know if this is under copyright.
I don't even know if this is under copyright or not. Well, that would qualify under CISPA as a reason why the government could then, without fear of any sort of judicial action, they would be able to read your emails. They would be able to seize any of the content in the history of your internet web browsing. They would be able to get any personal information that you transmitted by email, including tax returns, things like that, all in the name of cyber terrorism. Ron Paul can be quoted as having said, "It's a big brother writ that cuts into the resources of private industry to work for the nefarious purpose of spying on the American people." So it's being widely perceived in the blogosphere as a way to take away any sort of internet privacy that individuals have been afforded to this point, and it may be unconstitutional under the Fourth Amendment.
In your view, how much privacy should a person have?
I think that unless a person is legitimately suspect of a crime, that they should be afforded the benefit of the doubt of keeping personal information private.
Charles, what do you think?
I've been following this, and my son, who, as I mentioned earlier, my son Michael Lipson is a web designer, and
he's the one that's working,
and he writes me often about this because, like Sean was saying, people who blog and who are actively involved are very interested in this. Basically, what you have on one side of this is the national security people and the movie people, because they're afraid that anything that they produce as a movie could be stolen and they want protections. On the other side is essentially everybody who uses the internet.
Yes, and where I come into this personally is as a recorded musician with a lot of material out there, I am not in favor of having unlimited copyright. I'm not in favor of slapping somebody with a fine if they happen to stream or download a piano recording that I've made. I think that there has to be a balance between a limited period of copyright that is only of a certain scope that affords somebody the ability to create and make new material versus this black hole of national security. The NSA is building a $2 billion facility in Denver.
But it's not just the national security. It's also the people in the movie industry and so forth. There's a reason why Mickey Mouse is still under all the intellectual property protections, because it's a core element of the Disney company. And they and some other people have stretched what used to be a fairly short-term protection.
Right. They've gone through
Mickey
three.
Mickey Mouse first came out right before 1940. And these
1928,
are,
and it's been extended three times.
But not just for Mickey. Everything gets protected
well,
this
when
way.
When we come back, I want to hear from Chris and Dan on the same subject. Also, 1-800-723-8289. And I can also report to you that we have a another nomination for vice president coming in, and you'll hear that when we continue. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. And we do have someone listening tonight, Newport News, Virginia. He's listening to us in on XM, satellite radio. He's Jeff, and he has another name that he would like to put into the hopper for discussion for running mate for Mitt Romney. And it is who?
Pat Toomey, senator from Pennsylvania.
That's that's a good choice. What do you think of that one, Chris? Big state. Catholic?
Big state, Catholic.
Conservative?
Conservative. Toomey's actually really built up a lot of credibility for himself as a senator in his first term, one of the lead budget negotiators. This precedent that Obama started that you can get a couple years under your belt in a branch of government and then run for the highest office of the land. It doesn't sit well with me.
Wasn't Toomey in the House before?
He was in the House.
He was in the House.
U.S. attorney. Wasn't he a U.S. attorney?
I didn't know about that, but I knew he had a long House track record. It's for those reasons that
Rick Santorum endorsed Arlen Specter over
Toomey, and Toomey wound up winning. It's for all those reasons that I just feel a little uncomfortable about the Rubio prospect.
Jeff, why do you like him?
Well, he checks all of Romney's boxes. He's got the fiscal hawk credibility and the Tea Party credibility. He not only was in the House, he kept a term limit pledge when he left.
Yeah.
He comes from the wing of the party that Romney isn't appealing to. He performs better among a lower-income demographic than Romney does.
Mm-hmm.
He's from Pennsylvania. He's a member of the Hispanic caucus. He and Rubio are the only two senators in the Republican Hispanic caucus.
He's from Western Pennsylvania, correct?
No, Eastern. He's from Allentown.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, he's from Allentown.
How is he in
from that part of the state in like 150 years?
How is he part of the Hispanic caucus?
His mother's Portuguese. He was part of the Hispanic caucus when he was in the House as well.
Do you know if he speaks Spanish?
I have absolutely no idea. He was Portuguese, I guess not. He probably speaks Portuguese.
Portuguese.
It's an excellent point.
You don't have to speak Spanish. You just speak Portuguese.
Yes. Yeah.
So
that could be impressive, too.
This is a very interesting choice. This is a very interesting, serious point.
This is why we have this program, because the voices from beyond the Beltway have better ideas than the same old folks.
He's somebody who should be taken very seriously. I think this is one who deserves really serious vetting.
We endorse your. How do we move it along?
Well,
are we going to create a draft movement this evening? What are we going to do?
There's one other aspect to him that makes him especially attractive. It doesn't get a lot of attention, but
he's tall. He's very tall, is he not?
Was referencing it earlier, and it was the Senate has its own budget plan, the Senate Republicans do, that's the converse of the Ryan plan, and it's known as the Toomey plan. And he's gotten the 47 Senate Republicans behind it. That's pretty impressive for a deficit reduction package, considering the ranks of the Senate Republicans.
What do you think, Sean? Now the wheels are going through your head. He's Pennsylvania. It's a big state.
There's a pro and a con here that I'd like to discuss. The pro side of it would be, I would suspect that if he's well respected throughout Pennsylvania, there's a little bit of Eastern Ohio there too. You know, we've got another swing state in this.
That's my point.
The con side of this is, look at Biden. Biden had almost 30 years of experience in the Senate when he was picked as the VP choice for Obama.
And he considers Pennsylvania his second home state.
Right. So in this particular case, are we not just swapping Toomey for Portman?
Yes, we are.
I mean, in terms of the level of experience.
You would be, but the point that Jeff, the caller, is making is that Toomey's strength would be that he would bring along more sort of activism in terms of the base, but there may be some negatives on that, too. And I don't know how they play, for example, on a variety of women's issues. Jeff, do you know that?
Jeff is gone.
Jeff is gone. I mean, obviously, this is why I think there's going to be a very serious vetting.
When you say on a woman's issue, you mean?
Well, for example, we had a discussion earlier. Sean was bringing up.
He's probably pro-life. I would assume he would be pro-life.
But I'm talking about there have been a number.
Economic issues.
Well, no. I'm thinking that there are a number of issues related beyond being pro-life that have to do with transvaginal ultrasounds, all of these things that are perceived by many women as being extremely intrusive and are different from simply being pro-life.
I hope we don't have that in the debate, presidential debate.
I think
we don't go there.
I think what many Democrats, I think, are accurately portraying as a war on women, I think that concept is getting more and more traction. And I think
by the Democrats,
yeah,
their friends in the media.
Among the Democrats,
I haven't heard anybody talking about it at Dominic's. They don't talk about it at Dominic's.
No. Well, look, I think I saw an article that said the swing voter this year is a suburban Catholic married woman with kids. That's kind of the core swing voter, and these sort of very invasive tests that you're requiring women to go through if they want to have an abortion, and Equal Pay Act, the voting against the Lilly Ledbetter, the choosing economic policies that are continuing to make it harder for women to get ahead. I think Democrats are seeing that there's more and more traction that women this year are getting more fired up than they have been, that there isn't that they are perceiving an attack on them. And
Alex Castellanos was on Meet the Press today, and he said that if you're over, I believe it was 44 years old, and you're a woman, you're making more money than a man.
Yeah, there's a lot of pushback I saw on.
So it's the young 30-something single woman that you're talking about. Which is basically part of the Democratic core anyway.
That's a core Democratic piece. That wasn't true, by the way. At least
I
saw
like
on the other
point
side.
Either. I thought Maddow had a better point about it, which was
she kept yapping all the time.
Have we gotten up to that 77 cents or not?
Right.
Where do you weigh in on this, Mr. Voronis?
Well, I think the Democrats are just trying to extend a narrative that is they're trying to get out of their base into the mainstream to pose a problem for Romney. I don't see it. I don't see it. I see it as an extension out of the contraception Catholic Church mandate that the Obama administration fumbled and tried to recover.
I want to.
That would have been a big case. That would have been a far bigger case if Santorum was the candidate, but he's not the candidate.
I want to reframe this slightly. It seems to me that what's happening here, and you've seen it for a number of years on the Democratic side, is that Democrats try to build a winning coalition in an additive way. They appeal to women, union workers, Hispanics, students, the 99%. You go after them with very specific appeals.
You think those are additive?
I think
it's division.
Well that's attractive. What I'm saying. Yeah, right. In other words, what I'm trying to distinguish it from is a big national campaign where Reagan, for example, is saying we're going to cut taxes, we're going to have a strong defense. These are not appealing to specific interest groups. And the irony here that I think, no, there are groups that will like it more and groups that will like it less. But that's different from tailoring a campaign. I'm going after college students. I'm going to appear on college campuses. I've got specific policies for you on student loans. I've got a specific policy for you if you're Hispanic. That, I think, is the nature of this year's Democratic campaign, and I think it's different from the Republican campaign.
Independent voters right now who are scrutinizing both candidates and looking at them by the numbers and giving them both pluses and minuses are thinking this. Romney doesn't scare us. Romney does not scare independent voters, period, because voters look at him and say, well, if he made a tough call, I don't think I'm going to lose anything, especially on the social issue.
I think that's right.
The Obama administration
Jimmy Carter even said that. Jimmy Carter said that. Not that he's exactly what Democrats want to quote, but even Jimmy Carter said he wouldn't.
He's never been a rabid right-wing guy. He's never been a Tea Party guy.
But Obama's looking for the war on woman bullet to make him the rabid conservative that he's clearly not.
Well, the problem is it's like voting for a moderate Republican in your congressional district, but you're empowering the Tea Party to run the House of Representatives. Because you got John Boehner as a speaker. If you have a Democratic speaker, there's a major difference in policy than a Republican speaker.
Boehner, we're talking about Mitt Romney.
Right? But that's the same point, right?
It's not the same point.
It is, because he may not come from the right wing, but he is so inauthentic and he's such a panderer that the reason he's been able to win the primary is because he's pandered to the Tea Party and the right wing base. That's his problem now, is that after spending the last 4, 6, 8 months, I don't know what, convincing the Tea Party that I've never been one of yours, but I will do or say anything to get this nomination. Yeah. So I will do or say anything
so
you want.
Prove it by
now that he's
VP
done it, he's now got to somehow convince the independents. No.
Independent voters look at that, see the promises and the pandering that he's made, and know in his heart, if it came down to it, they're okay.
But they also
they don't feel threatened.
Well, first of all, way too early to say that, because independent voters are not scrutinizing these candidates, and there haven't been a vigorous exchange of ideas yet.
Well, he had a big drop. Romney. Romney had a big drop with independents like 2 months ago, but he's inching his way back up in the polls as
we speak. I mean, let's just analyze the situation for a second. Conservative voters are going to go with Romney. The independent voters in the swing states are going to be where he's going to have to put his effort.
And
if you look for a VP candidate that is going to do well with those independents, whether they're Tea Party or not, then you can add to his campaign that way. That can be the additive effect on the Republican side.
There you go. That's another reason, Pat Toomey. Look for him. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us around the table this week. We have Republican Chris Varonis. He is a public affairs expert. He's the president of ASOP Communications Group. Our Democrat is Dan Johnson. He's the president of Progressive Public Affairs. He's a lobbyist, attorney, a blogger. Also, libertarian Sean Bennett joins us. He has his own arbitrage company and a music licensing company as well, or a music...
A jingle company.
And Charles Lipson joins us. He is the Peter B. Ritzma Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago, and he's author of the book Doing Honest Work in College. 1-800-723-8289. I got a little more information on Pat Toomey. He was elected to the United States Senate from Pennsylvania on a platform of limited government. He's joined the Senate just in 2011, so he's not been there long. He introduced a 10-year balanced budget proposal that received more votes in the Senate than any other budget plan in 2011. He serves on the Budget Committee, the Commerce Committee. He previously served in the House of Representatives as a member of the Pennsylvania's 15th Congressional District, where he championed economic growth and fiscal discipline. He retired from the House in 2004. He fulfilled his 3-term limit pledge, a politician that kept his pledge. He also serves as the president of the Club for Growth, and that is owned and operated and has operated a chain of small restaurants in the Lehigh Valley and worked in the financial services industry. And guess what? Here's that magic college again. A graduate of Harvard University, he lives in Zionsville with his wife, Chris, that's with a K, and their 3 children.
All off the top of his head.
Amazing.
Right there.
Amazing. What do you want next?
Again.
Right. Let us go to Chris, calling from Palatine, Illinois. He's got another name he's putting in the hopper for vice presidential running mate with Mitt Romney. Go ahead, Chris.
The perfect candidate.
Okay.
Appeals to minorities. He carries the state of Florida, and I refer to the one and only. And by the way, he also would help shore up Romney with the Tea Party and the really hardcore, rabid right-wing Republicans. Alan West, Congressman.
Congressman Ta-da! Alan West, one of the bright lights of the Republican Party, is certainly
right. and also a gaffe master.
Even better than Sarah Palin.
A gaffe master, someone who called some 68 members of the House communists a few weeks ago.
I thought that was appalling. I really did. I've heard him say some things that were okay and fine. He served his country for many years in the military. But I think this idea that you're calling, I thought the number was 80, but I don't like to be back in this McCarthyite world in which you're calling people names like this.
Did he have a list?
Yeah, the Congressional Progressive Caucus. He said they were all communists.
I have a list, Senator.
So I think
it'd
be
no
like
shame, Bruce. Have you no shame?
Be like Sarah Palin,
Chris. I would say that your idea did not go over as big as Pat
Toomey. But you see, he's actually fruitier than Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann combined. So he'd be a perfect candidate for Romney. he'd add life and color to Romney.
Well, he would also. I think he's probably got a greater future as a political commentator.
Right. Fox News is calling him.
When his days are over, of course you don't have to be off the political payroll to be on Fox's payroll.
No.
So the same thing
these days, right?
Well, in some cases. But they are number one. Just remember that.
No doubt
every
about it.
Every time you think they're doing a lousy job, just remember it is you that is in the minority.
Well, and every time you have a gaffe, you get 2 days of press out of it. So.
Remember.
Yeah.
We did
elect a president.
I know you elected a president.
You know.
It's a problem, though.
The question is: are you going to re-elect a president? Because do you believe? And I don't think I've asked you this question. How likely is it that this unique coalition that he put together, and then he was able to take that coalition and jack it up to about 89% of enthusiasm? How likely is he going to be able to do that again?
I think the likelihood is zero that it'll be the same. 2008 was unique. Every election's unique. But the 2012 election will be different than the 2008 election. And the white-hot enthusiasm for making history and the reaction to arguably the worst president of the century and ending that string
so
of
harsh.
Policies.
That's so harsh.
Arguably. I said arguably. So that won't replicate in 2012. But I do think it's more likely than not that we will be talking about President Barack Obama in the year 2013, 14, 15, and 16.
From Dan's own mouth, you get validation to Romney's central critique of Obama that this guy's over his head.
That's not what I said at all.
He's pretty good speechifying, but when it comes to managing the government, this week, actually, there was a story that should have gotten more attention. It didn't. It was the Special Inspector General report on TARP, which concluded that the bailout made banks bigger, smaller independent banks got squeezed out, and lending, like Obama wanted, did not happen. And at the height of the recession, Obama, who went after Wall Street, the salaries and the compensation of Wall Street bankers in New York went up 16% in 2010. So you've got candidate Obama with the rhetoric, and you've got the reality of Obama, the president, with a huge gulf in between.
Now, how can you –
huge
first,
gulf.
Let me take the words that you put in my mouth. Let me take them out and say, how could – the guy who runs Bain Capital make that argument? How can the Republican Party, which is now essentially funded by
Dan,
and let me make my point.
I'm just holding Obama to his own words.
So then
I'm just holding him accountable after 4 years.
But then
how can you possibly say,
as the Republican, I'm representing the interests of Wall Street, Barack? You weren't hard enough on Wall Street, so therefore vote for the Wall Street
candidate. I would argue that it's sure. neither Romney nor Obama's fault. I would say that it's the independent cartel of multinational banks that control the Federal Reserve and other high finance entities, which are running off with these TARP funds, hoarding them, putting them in some Cayman Islands account, and then letting the fallout happen where it may. Either way, whatever candidate we get for president in 2012 is going to be essentially a bobblehead for the Fortune 500 and a cartel of banks.
I think that the debate between Dan and Chris was essentially the debate that you will hear during the election. Chris made a series of arguments about failure of the Obama administration, and Dan came back and said, your guy is worse. And that is going to be the nature of it. And why is that the case? Because what you don't hear from Chris when he's talking about Romney is, here's a series of great big thoughts and how he's going to do it. And what you don't hear from Dan is, gee, the stimulus was great. Gee, the health care plan was great, because those don't test very well. And then his immigration policies have really turned into great law because there haven't been any. And you don't hear much. You will hear a talk about economic performance, but again, it'll largely be negative. So I think what I heard between you two is the campaign in miniature.
I think you're right. And now let's move to the most important issue that we have to discuss this evening, and that is somebody's got to get to 270 electoral votes or they're not going to be the president.
You're right about that.
And if you listen and read some things that the Romney campaign has been talking about, they think that they can get to 290 votes, electoral votes, the way they assess it. So there's just a 20-vote gap, so anything could happen. And George Will last week on This Week made the case with a couple of flips in states. It could be 269-269, and the House of Representatives could decide it. But one of the interesting things in talking about all these, you know, woulda, coulda, shoulda roles that these people are dealing with, it said that no Republican has carried Pennsylvania, Michigan, or Wisconsin in any of the last five presidential elections. So I want to zero in, and these are states, mm-hmm, obviously, on your list, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. To me, I don't know how Romney wins Michigan.
Right. I don't think it's going to happen.
That's not going to happen. Wisconsin, I think we're going to get a sense of where Wisconsin will go when the recall of Governor Walker takes place in the next month.
He's polling at 69% on Intrade right now for winning his seat again.
And the third state is the state we just talked about, and that is Pennsylvania. Where does Pennsylvania go? And would the addition of Pat Toomey on that ticket, would that flip? I mean, everybody's talking about Ohio, right, but you know, maybe Ohio is less of a challenge than Pennsylvania, and maybe Pennsylvania would be a bigger pickup.
So what's interesting about Pennsylvania, and again, Dan, you know, said it himself, 2012 is going to be a very different electoral map for Obama from 2008. He's not going to win West Virginia. He's not going to win Indiana.
Well, he didn't win West Virginia last
year. Or Virginia.
North Carolina is going to be
North Carolina. Yeah. Florida could also be suspect, too. Mm-hmm. But the key thing to remember is Bush 2000, Bush Gore, and then Bush Kerry in 2004. Pennsylvania, the spread there was about 2-3%. So Pennsylvania with potentially what the caller said to me back in the ticket, you could put Pennsylvania in play.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think that that Romney could win if he doesn't win Florida? I don't see how he wins if he doesn't win Florida.
I think Florida is one of those
must-win states.
I agree with you, Bruce.
But the other question that when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about what's going to happen up in Wisconsin. But going again, another name that's been mentioned is Paul Ryan as a running mate for Romney, and I want to find out what everybody thinks of that. And we've also got some more people weighing in on our deep stakes discussion this evening, and we'll hear from them in Spokane, Washington, when we come back. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We've got Chris Veronis, the Republican, Dan Johnson, our Democrat, Libertarian Sean Bennett, and Charles Lipson is the voice of academia this evening. Mike is our caller. He's calling from KXLY in the beautiful city of Spokane, Washington. Nice to hear from Washington tonight.
Thank you, Bruce. The home of Bing Crosby, by the way, as you know.
That's right. Gonzaga University. I remember it well.
Exactly. God bless Bing Crosby. Well, there's a couple reasons for a Catholic nominee for vice president for the Republicans, a pro-life Republican vice president, mm-hmm. The Catholics are the swing vote, 23 million Catholics. 4 years ago, 54% of the Catholics voted for President Obama. According to some polls, today it's less than 50%. And many Catholics remember the Obama mandate through health and services infringing on freedom of religion. Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, Florida have many Catholics, as you know, Bruce. So the economy is a factor, of course, but freedom of religion for many Catholics will be an issue.
Well, and you know, the caller, that's actually a really good point. I mean, the fact is Catholic voters are the largest organized political bloc, religious political bloc in the country. It is true that a majority, I think 6 out of 10, disagree with the church on major issues, but the segment that does vote leans right, leans conservative, mm-hmm. which does not favor Obama.
Well, it's interesting. I think the caller's right. Catholics are a swing constituency this year, but the Catholics that are the swing Catholics are those that don't attend church regularly. Those that do attend church regularly are essentially largely Republican, and they're not swing voters. But people that, you know, I think we know a lot of them. They're sometimes pejoratively called cafeteria Catholics, but people who almost culturally identify as Catholic.
And they swing.
But they swing, and they do not sort of identify with the, you know, the rules of the church. You know, they practice birth control. They don't go to church every week.
What would concern me if I were in David Axelrod's office was that every one of these constituency groups that gets mentioned, Obama's not doing better than he was last time. He's significantly more vulnerable. Now, he won significantly last time. That gives him a cushion. But on each of these groups, he looks more vulnerable to me. Catholics, a variety of other
Hispanics.
Groups. Hispanics, and I can't think. Can you think of any segment where you think he's going to do better?
College professors,
young people's.
Oh, but they were so enthusiastic last time.
Yeah, but they're older. But they're breaking with Barack in the same proportion as they did 4 years ago.
85% of college graduates are moving home with their parents.
And
there's $1 trillion.
5%.
Yes, there's $1 trillion in outstanding student debt. If Obama hadn't come out and said, "We're going to do what we need to do," and even though it wasn't really him doing it, it was kind of a non-issue to make sure that the student loan rates didn't double because they weren't going to let it go through anyway.
That's not a non-issue.
It was something he framed as an issue in order to make it appear divisive when really they weren't going to let the student loan rate
expire. You can't count on that. They don't want to spend government money on student loan rates. The Tea Party is against spending taxpayer money on keeping student loan rates down.
They came right back out and they said, the Republicans said, you know, we're going to go ahead and, you know, renew this. We were always going to renew this. And, you know,
give us we have like less than 3 minutes left. I'm going to give everybody about 30 seconds. Give me your summary, Chris. Where do you see the race coming down? On the electoral map, what are the states that are going to decide it for? I assume you think that Romney's going to win. Is that correct?
I don't know if Romney's going to win. I don't.
Okay.
I think it'll be really close. But really quick, I honestly think in doing all the calculations, I forget what the website is that Dan and I have been to before, but I think there's a good chance Florida and Ohio would go to Romney, which to me means the race would be settled out west with swing states with low electoral vote count, New Mexico,
Colorado.
Sean.
In order for Romney to win, he needs to hold Montana and Missouri. He doesn't need Wisconsin, and according to my calculations, he needs to move 825,950 voters in 7 of the following states to win: Indiana, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Florida, Ohio, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Nevada, and Colorado.
That doesn't sound like a great challenge.
It seems like he has to get Florida, in my opinion. But if he gets a basket of 6 other states, it goes from 365 to 173 like it was in 2008 to 275, and that puts him over.
Professor?
There are 10 states that are battleground states, but the key statistic last week was the 2.2 GDP growth. If GDP growth remains weak, states like Ohio, Florida, Virginia, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, there's a real chance that they'll vote Republican. A month ago, I thought this was Obama's election. I now think that it's more likely that Romney will win if the economy remains soft.
Dan.
I'd just like to note how ridiculous it is that the people that happen to live in battleground states get to pick the president and the rest of us get to wish we lived there. What a horrible way to choose a president we have. We need to reform the electoral college.
Some states have to provide the funding, and Illinois is where people come to get the checks.
Isn't it absurd? No reason.
You can fund their super PACs unlimited.
We all get to drive to Wisconsin or take the train. Oh, wait, Scott Walker killed the train, so we can't take the train. California and Illinois,
secure blue states, provide almost a huge proportion of the funding, along with Texas, a secure red state.
Yes,
you're right. But when the Democrats start complaining about the Electoral College, you get a feeling that there's trouble ahead.
Yeah.
That's why, but to answer
your
question,
ahead.
I think Arizona is the dark horse potential swing state.
Arizona.
With young people, a lot of young people in Arizona and a lot of Latinos.
And a lot of old people.
God bless
young
the old people.
And a lot of unemployed people.
And a lot of unemployed people.
That's right.
All right. Well, we'll factor all that out. We've got several months we can go over this again.
Yes, and the big Wisconsin recall election coming
that's
up.
That's right. That's coming up. And again, that will be obviously... that is going to tell us a lot about where that state's going to go in November as well.
Yes.
On that note, we're out of time for our guest this evening, Dan Johnson Weinberger. Dan Johnson, by the way, I should say, and Chris Veronis and Charles Lipson and Sean Bennett. They have all joined us this evening. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman and Khalil Palil for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week at the same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.